So I went into my egg collection, and the next day they phoned and said, I'm sorry, none of them have made it. And it was just a sense of sort of multiple failure, that not only had we not managed to conceive naturally, now we weren't conceiving through IVF, and actually it was clear that it was my fault because it was my eggs.
Hello and welcome to Time to Talk TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons. Our aim is to help you own your experience. I'm Hayley Manning.
And I'm Catherine Mousley. We'll be joined by guest Shima Tariq. Shima is a doctor with research interests in HIV in women, including in pregnancy and menopause. Shima's first son was conceived with the help of donor IVF, but sadly when her waters broke early, she had to make the decision to induce her labourer and deliver Altair at 21 weeks.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we were doing a little bit of research for this podcast and I put out the story about having Shima on, I just wanted to get a sense of people's challenges with IVF and TFMR. And a lot of the comments that came back, I noticed that they were very similar sounding, to the challenges that I've had with TFMR. You know, these worries about trying again, you know, my body failed me, and yeah, the sort of fear around that. And also the sort of really wanting my baby and yet having to make this decision. And I thought, oh yeah, that I felt like that too. And then I went, hang on. Yeah, but IVF, that's not my experience. So IVF, I am imagining, amplifies those feelings by 1,000%.
That's a whole extra layer, isn't it? Like another hurdle to get through before you get to the end result.
And another trauma. Yeah. I mean, whenever I've heard women talk about their IVF journey, and they tell me about the appointments and the needles and the drugs and the constantly being examined and all this kind of stuff, it sounds bloody traumatic.
And the anxiety. And then not to mention the financial implications as well. Yes. And the test on your relationships and the time.
Yeah. So that's the thing that really kind of stood out for me, was that yes, there's some similar comments about what you might say about your TFMR afterwards, but yeah, the IVF, it must just amplify everything and add to that trauma. So we thought, you know, we're not the ones that have the expertise or the experience.
For once.
Yeah, we don't have, we're definitely not experts, but we don't have the experience of IVF. So I think it's best just to bring Shima in. And welcome, Shima, and please tell us your experience, your IVF journey, and what happened.
Hi, Hayley. Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much for inviting me on today. I don't know where to start. Hayley, in your introduction, you've summed up so many aspects that resonate with me in terms of my journey. And I'm sure it will be the same for lots of listeners. Where would you like me to start?
Well, maybe start with your IVF journey, where that sort of began and where it took you to, you know, up to your conceiving with Altair, and then what happened from that point?
Right. So I started trying to conceive back in 2014, and I knew it might be tricky because I was in my late 30s. So I was, I just got married and I was 37, 38. Mm-hmm. And because I work as a doctor, I knew that the stats weren't really in my favour, but I kind of thought, well, hopefully we'll be lucky and I'll be able to conceive. And if that doesn't work out, then we'll go for IVF. So already the possibility of IVF was in my head because I was being quite sort of realistic about my chances. I guess that's kind of a reflection of my personality as well, is assume the worst is going to happen and then you're not going to be disappointed. So my husband and I were trying for about 6 months and nothing was happening. And I didn't want to wait any longer because of my age. So I went to see my GP and they agreed that they'd refer me to a fertility clinic on the NHS. That took another 6 months, by which time I was 39. So you just feel the clock just ticking so loudly at this stage.
That's that sense of time I spoke about earlier, wasn't it?
Yeah. You feel like it's a race against time because all the stats are saying that IVF over the age of 40, the chances are really, really low. Plus also once you're over 40, you're not entitled to any NHS fertility treatment. So there were financial sort of pressures as well to just want to be referred in. Plus, we were just really, you know, by that stage, we'd been trying for a year. We were just ready. We were so ready to have children. We thought we were ready. So, yeah, we've finally seen. And I think that's where my naivety came in, despite the fact that I'm medical. I just assumed IVF would work. It just did not occur to me that it wouldn't. So I remember going in and feeling really positive and thinking, you know, yeah, I've got to do all this treatment, but it's fine because we'll have a baby at the end of it. I guess I'd never really talked to anybody who'd been through IVF, and I didn't really grasp just the fact that the majority of cases, it just doesn't work out. And most women need to have multiple cycles. And even then, there's no guarantee. So we went through our first cycle, and I just had a really terrible response to IVF. I think I produced one or two eggs, and neither of those eggs made it to the next day where they could even sort of think about fertilization. And up until that point, you know, I'd coped really well with the scans and with the medication. I mean, it's everything you described, Hayley. It's injecting yourself with drugs to basically induce menopause. And then you inject yourself with drugs to stimulate your ovaries, and you're just in this absolute storm of hormones. I guess because I'm medical, so injecting myself wasn't such a big deal. It didn't faze me. Taking medication didn't faze me. Going for scans, you know, in that way I was quite lucky because it's quite a familiar environment. But you can imagine if you're not used to medical settings, how distressing it could be.
Yeah, the fear of the unknown, I guess, as well. And
yeah, and it's just such a weird way to conceive. I mean, you know, the majority of the world don't have to go repeatedly into a doctor's office and have a scan stuck up their vagina.
This is what I meant by the sort of trauma that it gets built up. Yeah,
and it's reinforced again and again with every appointment, every test, every scan. So I remember, so I went in for my egg collection, and you know, had been put under anaesthetic, and then when I came round, they'd said we only got two eggs. And I was just devastated, but I kept thinking it's all right because one of them will be fine. And then the next day they phoned and said, I'm sorry, none of them have made it. And I was just distraught because it hadn't occurred to me that that would have happened. And it was just a sense of sort of multiple failure that not only had we not managed to conceive naturally, now we weren't conceiving through IVF, and actually it was clear that it was my fault because it was my eggs that were the issue. It was awful.
Got that grief before you've even started.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge grieving process to sort of realize that you just can't do this thing that you just thought you would be able to, and it just totally shook my confidence. So because of my age, the clinic was really nice and they said they'd rush me through for the next cycle very soon. So probably within 6 weeks, I was starting again on the hormones. And that one was even worse. So I didn't produce any eggs whatsoever.
Gosh, Shima.
Yeah.
You're breaking my heart.
It's awful. And there's nothing you can do. And because I guess I'm the kind of person who's used to working really hard and achieving something.
Yeah.
And this is out of your control a little bit, isn't it?
Totally out of my control. Yeah. It doesn't matter how hard I work. There's nothing I could do to change this. And for someone who's used to being in control, that was really, really hard to accept. After that second cycle, we went back to the clinic, and a doctor was crying as she was telling me that basically she thought there was no chance of me ever conceiving with my own eggs, that I had something called diminished ovarian reserve. So my ovaries had aged faster than you would expect, even for someone in their late 30s. I was basically responding to IVF like someone who was in their mid to late 40s.
Okay.
And she was clearly really upset because she'd identified quite strongly with me, I think.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated her honesty, because I'd said, well, can we try this type of IVF? Can we try lower doses of medication? Because that sometimes works. And she said, you know what, we could, and I could do that for you, but I just want to be honest that it's just not going to work. Mm. And you need to think about donor egg conception.
Mm.
And I'm so grateful that she was just frank with me.
It's sort of at that stage, it's the compassionate and humane thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah. Not to raise false hope, because actually, if I'd not been told that, I might have just gone into the sort of private IVF world and basically annihilated all our savings, because you're so vulnerable to being exploited by private clinics who promise that they can get results with older women. I needed someone to say, you know what, this just isn't going to work. You need to think about another way of doing this.
And at that moment, how did it feel? Did you feel like, okay, I need to hear this, or was it hard to hear that at that moment?
It was hard to hear. I remember getting the tube, and my husband had to go back to work, so I had to sit on the tube trying to digest this, and I was in tears. And just coincidentally, a friend happened to be on the tube that day, and so she saw me and she said what happened, and I just told her everything, and she was lovely, and she just took me to a cafe and sat with me until my husband was able to leave work and come and collect me from the cafe and take me home. So I wasn't okay, because basically I was being told I'd never have my own child genetically.
It's a huge impact, isn't it? Yeah. You expected to kind of go back to your normal life, as it were, before you've been told this information.
How do you tell anyone that? It's a grief for something that hasn't yet happened, a grief for a child that you've not had. How can you sort of say to your friends, actually, I feel really, really bereft because I'm not going to have the child that I thought I would have?
It's that expectation, isn't it, that's just literally vanished in hours almost.
I think it's the death of the dream.
Yeah. And it's exactly that. And it was just opening up a whole world of, well, I don't really know anything about donor egg conception. Now I'm going to have to look into that. And how are we going to fit all the complexities that come with donor conception? But despite all of that, I think because I'm naturally a very pragmatic person, my attitude was, well, I really want to be a mum. Adoption for us wasn't ever an option, because my husband wasn't so keen. So it's like, actually, we have to do it this way, or that's it. We're not going to have children. And so I guess I just thought, you know what? Genetics isn't hugely important to me. I know that I'm capable of loving a child if I'm not genetically related to them. I'm open to the idea of donor conception. If that's the way we're going to have children, then that's what we're going to do. And from that point onwards, and that happened quite quickly, I switched my mindset and embraced it totally and thought, you know what, we're not a very conventional couple. You know, we're quite anti-norm in many ways and in our politics. So I just thought, you know what, we're going to do this in a very sort of sci-fi different way. It's fine and great. We can show people that you can build families in an alternative way. Yeah, it definitely felt like a more positive step.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's really quite beautiful listening to you talk like that, and it made me think about, well, what is a mother? What makes us a mother or a parent? Is it just that genetic link?
And it's not at all, is it? I mean, I think what makes you a parent is the everyday, sometimes really bloody hard parenting, day in, day out, when you're exhausted, when you're not feeling great, when your child's acting up, all those things. That's what parenting is. Mm. It's not anything to do with genetics or giving birth or any of that stuff. It's what comes after.
The conception is just a very small part of it, isn't it, compared to the next 18 years.
Exactly. Or as my mum would probably say, the next 45.
Yes.
I think when you see it in that light, those circumstances around conception become less of an issue. Or they certainly were for me. I know that's not the same for everyone. I know some people wouldn't even consider donor conception, but for us it was the right thing.
So you went on to conceive Altair with the donor egg.
Yeah, so we then had to switch to donor egg conception. That is only available privately in the UK. So that's when we sort of got involved in the murky private IVF industry. So because I'm Asian, I was really keen to find a donor who was also Asian, because it was important for me that my child looked a bit like me, at least in terms of the colour of their skin. And we had maybe that shared cultural background. And we were really lucky. We phoned around and there was a clinic in London that had some donor eggs from an Asian donor. So we put a deposit down on those eggs, which is a very weird thing to do. It's like I'm putting down a deposit on my future child. We were actually were given a choice between two donors and we angsted over them, but we went for one over the other for just an inkling, a sort of gut feeling more than anything. And then I think after about 6 months of a break, I went into a donor egg IVF cycle. So now we're on what, my third IVF cycle in the space of probably 18 months. That one didn't work. And that was absolutely, I was at rock bottom at that point. Okay, you told me my ovaries don't work. So I've moved on to doing donor egg IVF and now that hasn't worked. Where do I go from here?
And it's sort of like, universe, give me a break here, you know.
It really was.
Like, I'm doing what I'm being asked to do.
Yeah. You know, it's like, I am throwing everything at this. And everyone tells you, you know, donor egg IVF, that's the solution, isn't it? If you're older and you need to conceive, or if you've gone through early menopause, that's your way out of it. But yeah, it didn't work. And I think for my husband and I, that was one of our lowest points up until that point. It's like, where do we go from here? We're trying everything.
Were there answers as to why it didn't work, or no one knows why?
No one knows. And it was just probably luck, or those two embryos weren't, you know, there's something was wrong with them and they wouldn't implant. That's the whole thing with sort of fertility. We just, it's made me realize that whenever someone conceives naturally, it's a bloody miracle,
because everything has to line up. All your suns and moons and stars and everything.
It's kind of amazing any of us are here.
I know,
that's what it is. It's like, how the hell did human beings even get here?
You have to overcome all those obstacles, and this is before you have to take into account complex pregnancies and baby loss. It's like, you know, even to get to the point where you're like a cluster of cells, is, Catherine, you're right, it's like some sort of mad alignment of stars and moons and all sorts of things. Anyway,
yeah, those magic fairy people that are able to do it and they have no problems ever. I'm like, you have no idea, you have no idea.
I sometimes come across people, certainly being a doctor, so other doctors who are able to plan when they're going to be pregnant, so it fits around the calendar, and I'm like,
what?
I cannot imagine.
Scheduling, perfect scheduling assistant.
Yeah, it's like, God, I just, you know, I threw everything at it for years, put my life on hold to try and conceive.
Must stir up all these emotions though, like that sense of just bitterness and regret and jealousy and fairness. Then, you know, your mental health takes a deterioration, and it's, there's so many complex emotions surrounding it, and it's hard not to become that person, that all these emotions you are feeling on the inside become your outside personality.
Yeah, I mean, I became incredibly jealous of other people's pregnancies and quite bitter. For a long time, we weren't able to socialise with anybody who had kids. We just didn't want to see them. And I've definitely lost friendships as a result of that. But we weren't in the right place. We just couldn't do it. It was too painful, especially because we didn't know how our journey was going to end. And we were having to take on board the possibility that we would never be parents. And it was just too early in our journey to be surrounded by other people who had the one thing that we wanted. And people can sometimes make awful throwaway comments. I remember going for dinner with a friend and we were talking about it, and she had a kid. She had a little boy at that stage. And she just made this comment of like, yeah, I know, but at least you can go on holiday.
Oh, God. Like,
yeah.
Because that's really a good replacement.
Would you give up your child in order to go on holiday?
Yeah.
Is that how it works? The deal is that. And it was that kind of feeling of, oh, well, you know, at least you have all this time, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, but we have basically bought a bigger house in order to have children, and this house is empty. And you know, we're both older, we've done quite a lot in our lives, we don't want to go on holiday. I thought that at the time. Now in COVID, I'd do anything to go on holiday. You kind of then end up distancing yourself from people because they just say really hurtful things. It shows such a fundamental lack of understanding of what it means to want a child and not be able to conceive one.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, well, I don't want to go on a holiday. I want to start a family. That's my heart's desire.
I remember once when we had quite a scare early on with Jake, and someone said to me, maybe you're just not meant to have children. And it just hurts so much that you think, how on earth can you think that in your head, that it's something that's okay to say to someone?
I know. I've had people before tell me that you're not really a maternal person, are you? So what the hell does that mean? You're not really a maternal person. How do you know? Unless I'm mothering you, you've got no idea.
Exactly. Exactly.
You definitely do distance yourself from people. But after the third one failed, we decided to go again very quickly. Again, within 6 weeks, I was back on all the drugs. And we transferred two embryos, and one of them stuck. And that was the first time, by that stage it was 2017, so first time in 3 years I had ever been pregnant. First time I'd seen a positive pregnancy test in 3 years.
How did that feel?
You know what? It didn't feel great. I felt I was terrified right from the start. Those lines, which I'm sure you can both empathize with for different reasons.
Both times, actually. I think especially with Bud, I just knew. I saw those lines, and although I was shocked, I just didn't feel like I was ever going to see him grow up. And I think you just, I don't know, something, whether it's like motherly instinct or gut feeling. And I guess the second time around, it's, you just terrified. So terrified of what's going to go wrong.
Yeah, terrified it's all going to happen again.
Well, that naivety has been stripped away, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
You know that the worst things can happen. But yeah, this pregnancy felt so precious, but also so fragile because it was so precious. And because it took us 3 years to get there. And by that stage, probably £25,000.
Gosh.
And God knows how many injections. And it was like there was so much riding on this, because if it failed, then we were back at square one. You know, I just remember the positive pregnancy test just feeling terrified, just absolutely terrified. And that didn't go really for the whole of that pregnancy. So we went, it was a very difficult pregnancy right from the start. So the thing with IVF pregnancies is you know much earlier than anybody else would ever know that you're pregnant, and you're getting tests and you're being scanned. So you're kind of, it almost instills an anxiety because the majority of women wouldn't know they were pregnant until they were sort of 6 or 7 weeks down the line, whereas we know 2 weeks afterwards.
Yeah.
And it's constant monitoring. So one of the blood tests wasn't rising high enough. Then I was rushed in for a scan. I think it was at 5 weeks, and they thought that maybe the baby wasn't growing enough, and they warned me that there was a high likelihood of miscarriage. And that just confirmed my worst fears. And I just was paralysed at this stage, just thinking, we're going to lose this baby. How could we be so unlucky? How could we have gone through not being able to conceive naturally, gone through IVF, that not working out, then having donor egg IVF, and then going through that and finding out you're pregnant, and now being told that I'm likely to miscarry? It's like, how much more could happen?
It like taints your entire universe, doesn't it? Like everything has just got a tinge of grey to it, even black afterwards, because nothing feels happy anymore.
Nothing feels safe. You just feel like, well, the whole universe is fragile. Everything could be taken away from you at any point. So I had to go back for more scans. And then finally, I think at 7 weeks, they scanned me and there was a heartbeat and they said, no, everything's fine. And we took a deep breath and we were like, oh, God, great. But I think that trauma of having this sort of early miscarriage scare stayed with me, really haunted me. by this stage, my anxiety was through the roof, but I hadn't realised it was abnormal to feel that anxious. So I hadn't asked for help. I just assumed that it was normal. But looking back, I was suffering quite badly from prenatal anxiety. And then we went for a 12-week scan and that seemed to be okay. We went for a 40. So I was being scanned regularly because it was an IVF pregnancy and I was I was older, so I was at risk. Then we started to get we were put into this space of just bad news after bad news after bad news over the space of maybe 6 to 8 weeks. So first of all, we had a blood test which showed that probably my placenta wasn't functioning very well. I was then told it's likely that I would have to have a C-section, and that was yet another grief of everything else has been so medicalized and now I'm not even going to be able to give birth the way that I want to. Then there was lots of anxieties of, you know, this baby's likely to come early, so you're like, you know, you may well have a very preterm baby, so we're trying to get our heads around probably having a baby who was going to be on NICU. And then we had a scan that was absolutely awful, you know, and I'm sure you both relate to that awful scan where I must have been, 17, 18 weeks, and they scanned me and they didn't say anything for ages.
Scans.
No.
Yeah. Silent scans. Yeah.
Awful. Absolutely awful. And I still remember it clearly. And it was a Monday morning. And, you know, she didn't say anything. The ultrasonographer didn't say anything. And then she walked straight out and got somebody else in. And that's when you know that something bad is happening. So they said that basically the baby's growth was just off the scale. He just really wasn't growing at all. He was below the charts, really, in terms of his growth. But also the ventricles in his brain were large. So they thought something very serious was going on with him, but they didn't know what. So there and then I had to have an amniocentesis. So I'd just been given this news and then they were going to stick a needle in my tummy to take a sample straight away. And looking back, I just don't know how you just cope because you have to. But
well, you're in shock, I think.
Yeah.
The whole thing I remember is, you know, being told bad news like that. You're just in shock. And they sort of go, okay, now you go off to here. And you're like, okay. And you sort of shuffle off to this place and they shuffle you off. You're not thinking. So you go into this weird slow motion world.
I'm almost like you're doing what you have to do.
Yeah.
Because there isn't any other choice, really.
Yeah.
It's exactly that. You kind of do have to almost sleepwalk through it.
Yeah,
so they did an amniocentesis and I was just told to prepare myself for the worst, that it's likely that the baby had severe chromosomal abnormalities and that we would probably need to make a decision to terminate. And that was it. And that it would take 2 weeks to get the results. So I was just sent home with that news and thinking.
It's that void again, isn't it? That void of time. When you're just so paralyzed by fear.
Yeah.
And the research, you're just constantly researching, filling your head with all these stories and outcomes and convincing yourself you're not going to be that one or it'll be different on statistics, which don't mean anything to me.
Exactly. All of that. I was going on to every single sort of internet forum to try and say, you know, basically, did you have a small baby with big ventricles and did they survive? Desperately wanting to know that it would be okay, trying to see whether we could get a second or third opinion from someone, basically desperately wanting it not to be true, but also not really knowing what to do with myself as a pregnant person, because I remember we went to Kew Gardens or something and I was sitting on the tube and I had my badge on, my pregnancy badge on, and I was standing up and someone wanted to give their seat to me and I felt bad because I thought I don't have a right to that seat because I'm not really pregnant because I'm probably going to have to terminate this pregnancy. I'm not really a pregnant person. I felt horrified by my bump. I just couldn't bear to look at it because I felt like it felt like a graveyard.
Yeah.
I just felt like, you know, it's so hard to describe to people, but I felt like I wasn't carrying life. It was just this horrible thing that, you know, I was going to have to make this awful decision about very, very wanted, very planned for child. And I was in this limbo of being pregnant, but not really being pregnant anymore.
You feel like a fraud in some ways, don't you?
Yeah, that's exactly it, totally, isn't it?
You don't feel like you belong with all the pregnant
women. No.
Plus you have that feeling of guilt that you're going to have to make this awful decision, which of course you don't have any, you know, there's no alternative to that decision. It's not really a decision to make.
No.
No. I was going to say, now I remember literally wanting to grab anyone I saw by the arm and go, but I'm still a mum. I'm still a mum.
Yeah.
Like, you just want to say to people, like, this is still my baby, even though, you know, no one's ever going to see them.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. Yeah, we just, I don't know, we kind of retreated, didn't really tell anyone, didn't know how to tell anyone. The chromosomal test came back negative. We went for a scan and it looked like the baby was growing. And so suddenly everyone was like, deep breath, maybe things are going to be okay. Actually, if you can get to 24 weeks, things might be fine. And so we suddenly were like, oh, okay, maybe things are going to be all right. So we'd put our holiday on hold. So we actually thought, okay, no, we will go to Italy and like we'll carry on. And the day before we were due to fly, I was at work, went to the hairdressers, was getting my hair done before we went on holiday. And then as I stood up, I realised I was totally wet through. And I thought, that's odd, but it was a really hot day. So I was thinking, well, maybe I'm just, you know,
sweaty.
Yeah, really sweaty.
And then as I stood up, I was like, no, I know exactly what's happened. My waters are broken. And at that point, I was only 20 weeks pregnant. And it's like, ugh, I knew what that meant. So I phoned my husband up and said, I'm getting the tube home, you need to meet me on the other end and we need to go straight to hospital with my notes. And I had to do probably the most awful journey home ever, sitting on a packed tube, knowing my waters had broken and knowing that I was probably going to lose our baby.
It's like all this, that sense of derealization, I think, because you're so far apart from who you are and where you are and everyone else is just getting on with their day.
Yeah, it's that, isn't it? It's like, how can normal life carry on when this awful thing
and your world stands still
and no one knows it's happening to me? No one would have known that. So my husband picked me up, went to the hospital. Really awful treatment there, to be honest. I mean, by this stage I was soaked. I hadn't had a chance to go home and get a change of clothes. And basically the receptionist just told me to sit down in the waiting area. But because it was the maternity ward, every other woman there was about to give birth. So I was being sat next to women who are huge. And they actually sat me down next to a woman who was being discharged with her baby to go home. And I knew what was happening to me. And I knew what was probably going to be happening. And my husband went up to them and said, look, can you do something about this? This isn't appropriate. She can't sit here with her waters broken with lots of women who are having their babies. Plus she's also soaked through. And all they did was give him like a pad for me to sit on, which was so stigmatizing. So I was stuck in this like waiting room, sitting on a pad. It was just awful. They finally examined me, and then the doctor who examined me, because I kept saying, is everything okay? Is everything okay? And she was really patronising. She'd said, oh, there's no need to panic. It's like, you know what? There is every need to panic because I'm 20 weeks pregnant and my waters have broken. I mean, I'm not an idiot. It's like, if there's ever an appropriate situation to panic, this is that situation.
It just reinforces the fact that you don't feel like you matter at all.
Yeah. It's like, oh, pull yourself together, even though you're losing your baby at 20 weeks. So that was awful. And then, basically they confirmed that my waters had broken and actually there was no chance that our baby would survive that at 20 weeks, especially because he was growth restricted and he was small. Mm. And even if he did by any stretch managed to survive, he would have so many problems as a result of my waters breaking so early. And that if I wasn't induced, the longer my waters were broken, the more risk there was to me of getting an infection. So basically there was no decision. I basically had to be induced to save my life, which just sets a whole complicated set of emotions of,
We've had, just so you know, that we have had conversations with other women that have had terminations because of maternal health reasons. It really, it's another layer of complexity, and it's really difficult for these women in that way. Yeah.
This feeling
of being selfish or something, you know.
That's it. It's the feeling of being selfish. Like, you know, actually my life's more important here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they didn't have a bed for me. They sent me home. I remember coming home, packing my bags, having a shower, taking a last photo of my bump. I hadn't really taken any photos of my bump, but I thought I better take a photo just to document it. And then finally we went in and I was basically admitted onto the labour ward, hearing everybody else giving birth. I remember just really clearly asking them to remove the little cot from my room because I didn't want to see the cot. Because it's like, well, you know, I don't want that in my room because I'm basically about to give birth to a dead baby. So, yeah, they came round to give me the tablet to be induced. And before I took it, because I felt so conflicted about taking it, I knew I had to, but I was like, I'm going to be taking this thing that's going to end my child's life, because he was still alive and heart beating. It's like, I'm now going to do this and there's no going back. And before I did it, I asked the doctor if I could have one last scan. And she looked at me and said, well, what's the point? And it's like, because I need to say goodbye to my child. This is the last time I'm ever going to see his heartbeat. That's the point.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the point? It's not going to change anything. And it's like, no.
It's like, it does explain the gulf between physical and mental health, doesn't it? Because this is for your mental health here, but all they care about is your physical state.
Yeah.
Well, also it's your choice of how you want to birth, which does connect to your mental health, obviously. But this is, you know, you've been left with this horrible situation of being backed into a corner, of having something happening that you don't want to be what's happening. So for God's sake, if a mother requests something as simple as, please, can you just scan me again? What is the problem?
Yeah.
Just keep your mouth shut and do the scan.
Yeah.
That's what she wants.
Especially in this situation, above all other situations, because you only get one shot at this. It's like, you are not going to have a lifetime of building memories where you can, you know, I'm not saying that going through traumatic birth is easy, but you have the chance to heal and recover. You have a chance to be with your child.
Yeah.
This is it. Those are the memories you're going to make with your child. There is no future with them.
It's just totally, there's no excuse for it.
Yeah. Whatsoever. This has been trauma, there really isn't. Doesn't it? It's trauma.
Yeah, you're just heaping trauma on top of trauma. And it does make me really kind of go, why are you a doctor on the maternity ward?
Yeah.
I mean, I really want to swear right now, but you know, it's the, why are you a doctor or a midwife? You know, why are you working here if you are not able to show compassion to mothers?
Yeah. And to make you feel as though your baby matters. What it made me feel like is, this isn't really a baby.
Exactly. Exactly. And that is the trauma that is heaped on top of this. And that is the thing that afterwards, for the months and years afterwards, this is the kind of thing that sticks.
Yeah. And after 3 years of infertility, you know, that it just compounds all those feelings.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can imagine by this stage, it's like, I feel like a total failure, you know.
Yeah.
At every single point along this journey, my body had massively failed. And now in the worst way possible, and that my waters had broken, and then I had to take medication to induce labour. It was just, so yeah, you asked me about my IVF journey. That was a long one. So, oh God, the induction took ages. So it was probably 3 days later, and I had to have multiple doses, and I was so exhausted. I was lucky they did give me really good pain relief, so I was really out of it, to be honest, just totally out of it for most of it.
For like a silver lining.
Yeah, it's the only I mean, thank God they did it, because I don't think I could have coped, with the pain, but psychologically, I just actually needed to be knocked out.
Well, I think, you know, you just saying I was lucky they gave me really good pain relief. It's like, that shouldn't be a sort of lucky thing. That's just being humane. Yeah. Give the pain relief, for God's sakes.
Yeah,
or give women drugs to be able to cope with the situation.
Yeah.
Because
if they want it, if they want it. I get it if you don't want it, but if this is what you want and you need it, then by all means.
And by now, it's probably more mental than physical.
Well, this is it. I mean,
yeah,
I was getting to the stage where I was thinking, when is this ever going to happen?
Yeah.
Because I'm so frightened about delivering, because I didn't know what it would be like to have a baby born at that gestation. Yeah. And I was frightened of him. I'd already said that I wanted him to be taken away because I didn't want to see him and my husband didn't want to see him. And there was some talk about potentially having surgery, because by day three nothing had happened, and then that night Altair was born at around half five in the morning, and it was just so quiet because the midwife had left the room, my husband was asleep, and he just came out, and I was there on my own, and there was no sort of, you know, that's a silent birth, really.
Yeah.
Just the opposite of what you expect birth to be. And so I pressed the buzzer, midwife came, and she said, "Do you want to see him?" I was like, "No, just take him." So he was taken away, and I just slept. And the next day we were about to leave, and I just thought, you know what? If I don't see him, that's going to be the thing that I regret. Mm. And I understand people not wanting to see their child, but for me, it was like, I will never be able to undo that decision. So I'd rather go and see him and regret it than not see him and not be able to live with that decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they showed me some photos, and I thought, actually, he does look like a baby. Mm. I wish someone had said to me before I'd given birth that he'll just look like a really small baby.
Yeah. I remember asking with Luna, I was really terrified as well, Shima, about, oh my God, what is she going to look like? And I just asked my bereavement midwife, and she said she will look like a very small baby. She'll be quite pink because their skin is at that gestation. But yeah, you'll be able to see the hygromas, but she will just look like a tiny baby. Yeah.
It's still quite shocking. I remember saying to Chris, because even though I'd never seen a baby that small, I'm like, oh, well, you know, he is going to be a miniature version of a full-size baby. But even I didn't realize down to fingernails at that point, hair on their head, everything is completely fully formed.
Yeah.
It's a real shock, isn't it? So I went to see him and I held him, and I'm really glad that I did, because it made it much more real. I think it would have felt like a just very bad nightmare, but not real. And I went back and I spoke to my husband, because I felt the same for him. I felt like, actually, you need to hold him for this to feel like it's happened. So I decided to make a decision on his behalf and sort of almost push him into doing it. So he came with me, and we both spent some time together with Altair. And he has subsequently said that he's really glad that he had that, because it's helped him cope better.
Yeah.
And then we went home, and it was just awful leaving my baby behind. And I remember just coming home and howling.
Yeah.
Almost like an animal.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like primal screaming.
I've never experienced anything like it. It's like, you know, that sort of absolute emptiness.
You're just hollow. It like almost like there's no insides at all for you. You can see straight through you. It's just emptiness.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's just, I've never felt an emptiness like that. And the next day I went back in to see him, because I just thought, there's nothing that's going to make me feel complete. I just need to hold him. And then at that point, I knew I couldn't keep going every day. That was the last time I saw him. I left him a soft toy and a photo of us. And then I walked away. That was it.
But I want to give some people some hope after such a sad story. So after the success stories that you all search for online, you know, you are a miracle, and you went on to have another child by a donor egg, and then another miracle baby.
Yeah, so I've had a really crazy journey since then. So so after losing Altair, within 6 months, we decided we wanted to do more IVF. I didn't want my only experience of motherhood to be mothering a child who'd died. I couldn't leave it at that. So we tried again and it didn't work. And then we tried again. And this time we had to go abroad because we couldn't find any donor eggs that were suitable in the UK. And then finally, sixth round of IVF. Now we're 4 years down the line of trying. I finally was pregnant again. Very, very high risk pregnancy. There is a real risk that what happened to Altair would happen again. I have a very rare placenta condition. Okay. Which is just heaping sort of, I've definitely fallen on the wrong side of statistics every part of my journey. So I had a very highly medicated pregnancy. I had to have regular scans. Of course, scans are very triggering for me. My pregnancy with Tharys was just, I was a mess, like in terms of anxiety. Again, I didn't really ask anyone for help, didn't recognize that actually what I was feeling was prenatal anxiety. I wanted to be basically put in a coma for 9 months and woke up at the end because I just could not bear it. It was awful.
But I can identify with that quite a bit, actually.
It's just, you just feel like you're basically reliving your trauma daily.
No one takes it seriously as well. I remember being in triage and people were like, well, why are you here? You've got a healthy baby. But I was so terrified of losing him and not knowing about it or something I could have prevented.
And you don't trust your body to do anything. By that stage, I was like, well, my body is just total useless lump. So I can't trust it anymore to do anything right. But despite all of that, he was born kicking and screaming in December 2018. So I had a planned C-section because I didn't want to go through the trauma of another vaginal birth. I knew that I wouldn't be able to cope with it. I was lucky. I had a really great obstetrician and she supported me 100%. She said it was important to her that she give me a positive birth experience. She said the way that she thought I could achieve that was through a really gentle C-section. I think her concerns were because of my age and all my other sort of medical complications, that if things went wrong during a vaginal delivery, the experience would be very traumatic for me. So I'm so glad she said that. And I had a really fantastic, straightforward, gentle C-section. He was born without any complications whatsoever, was absolutely fine.
Can you just describe that moment of him being sort of shown to you or given to you, what that felt like?
It was just so, just absolute massive relief to hear him scream. It was just like, oh, thank God, you know, we've done it. But then when they handed him to me, I was just, I wish I could say that I felt that sort of rush of love and I felt overjoyed. I didn't. I felt overwhelmed because up until that point, my whole life had been around getting pregnant and staying pregnant. I hadn't once allowed myself to believe that I would actually have a baby. And so when they presented him to me, I was completely unprepared. I hadn't actually thought that was going to happen. So I didn't know what to do with him. And I actually felt really like totally overwhelmed.
Could really relate to that. In a good way. It's surreal, isn't it? And then you're like, well, what do I do now then? They're like, feed him, dress him. You're like, what? Sorry.
And I hadn't gone to any classes, haven't read any books. We haven't got anything for him until he was, 34 weeks gestation because I didn't want to tempt fate.
Yeah.
But I wasn't prepared at all. And I'd worked right up until the moment he was born because I didn't want to stop and have to think about what was happening. So I wasn't ready to be a mum. Wasn't ready to mother him at all.
It's like that shock and it's, you can't really explain, like this cold shock. You've wanted something for so long. Like how do you feel like this? What's going on? It's almost, I think it is like a form of self-preservation. You know, you've lost so much already that you can't bear to lose this one thing you now actually do have in your arms.
I think it's also that thing of being, well, I've had people asking about, well, how going on to have children again and trying again, and then you have your live baby, and the sense that, well, that's what's going to sort of fix things. But what I've sort of said to people is that this is a different baby. And what's really important is making sure that you've gone through the process of processing the trauma and the grief. And not to say that you'll kind of end that and then you'll be ready to have a child. You know, you can dovetail these things together, but I think it's about the space for both things. Because what I've heard a lot is that reaction of that when a live baby is then handed to you, this is not what you expected. Even though you wanted, it's not what you expected. And you haven't allowed your brain to even think about it.
Yeah, like it was ever going to happen. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think there has to be more awareness of that for women who've experienced loss in any way, but especially after termination for medical reasons, which does add a sort of unique layer of stigma. Mm. It's just to not have that expectation of yourself, to understand that being handed a live baby is going to just trigger all sorts of complicated emotions, and to be gentle with yourself and realize it's a process.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know what your experience has been, Catherine, sort of after losing Bud, but for me to be able to mother again, it's been a really, really slow process, and I've needed a lot of support and a lot of therapy and medication to get to that point.
No, I totally empathise with that. But you're expected to feel that rush of love again and you don't, and then you beat yourself up about that, and then you know, you don't instantly love this little person in front of you, and then that's another issue, and all this becomes so complex and tangled in this big tornado of emotions. Yeah. They're definitely similar experience to you.
Yeah, I think when you're sort of starting out motherhood in the midst of grief, it's just so, so complicated.
Absolutely.
But yeah, thanks to lots of support, Faris, my son, and I built a really, really strong bond. I had very severe postnatal depression, but I managed to get treatment for it and made a really, really good recovery. And I guess the final twist in this tale was I was just coming out of postnatal depression and I was feeling really tired. And I found out I was pregnant naturally after everything we'd been through with a 7-month-old baby. I'd managed to somehow conceive, having been told I would never conceive naturally. I was breastfeeding. I was 43. I'd been told I'd never conceive.
Yeah.
Oh man.
I am gonna just swear now, because it seems I'm allowed now. I've restrained myself enough.
Yeah.
It's a head fuck.
A massive head fuck.
Yeah. The universe is like, here for the final installment.
Yeah. Just when you thought it was all over.
People can hand you this one and see how you cope.
Yeah.
So yeah, we were absolutely shocked. Didn't really know how we'd cope. Obviously, I'd had a very, very difficult time after we'd had Faris, and it was only just coming through that. Didn't know how my body would cope. Went back again under the care of the Tommy's Research Centre up in Manchester, back on medication. And April 2020, my daughter Lyra was born.
In the middle of a pandemic. She couldn't even make it up, could she?
I mean, nothing about my journey has been straightforward. But what I would say is that Lyra's pregnancy and her birth and her being here has been so healing for me, because I was supported during my pregnancy. I was having therapy. I was under a psychiatrist. I was having medication. I was part of a really great peer support group of, you know, mothers who have had mental health challenges. And I was in a good place psychologically through that pregnancy. And also I was thinking ahead to what I needed to put in place to help me cope once she was born.
Mm.
I wasn't putting big expectations on myself to be perfect or to cope. So we used our life savings to pay for a nanny to come and live with us for a few weeks to help me out.
Mm.
I just knew what to do to prioritize my mental health. And it has meant that my experience of motherhood with her has been, I guess I see her as giving me the chance to experience what pregnancy and motherhood is like without being traumatized.
Yeah.
I think that's been an amazing, amazing gift. And she's just about to turn one. And I now have a 1-year-old and a 2-year-old. And I would never, ever have imagined that.
Mm.
looking back, you know.
Yeah, I feel quite emotional now.
I know.
Yeah, it's just a remarkable story.
It is a miracle of all miracles. I mean, a unicorn should come trotting across the,
yeah,
screen,
the screen right now. Exactly, exactly. It's just remarkable, and so much trauma and so much pain and so much grief. And here you are now. Yeah, I just thank you so much for sharing all of your experiences and all of your babies, and yeah, an amazing story. And you mentioned in that last bit about being supported by Tommy's, and you have now since gone on, you've been appointed as a trustee for Tommy's.
Yeah, I mean,
tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an amazing privilege. So Tommy's are the reason why Faris and Lyra are here safely. And that's not me just paying lip service. They are here because of the research that they do. I owe them everything. So we have always raised money for Tommy's, and I've always given interviews and done podcasts to support them. But last year they approached me and invited me to apply to join their board of trustees, not only because of my lived experience of baby loss, but also high risk pregnancy, but also because of my own research. Most of my research has been on pregnancy and women living with HIV, and I have a particular interest in how to reach out to marginalised communities, so women who are perhaps underrepresented, so women of colour, women from deprived backgrounds. So it's that amazing thing where they wanted me not just for my lived experience, but also for my professional experience. I'm able to bring both of those things to this role and to think about how we can carry on Tommy's amazing work, but to make sure we are as diverse and as inclusive as we possibly can be, and that we work in partnership, and that the voices of parents are heard throughout the process. For me, it's just the biggest honour, because Altair isn't physically here, and because he was born before 24 weeks, there's no birth certificate and there's no death certificate, so his life isn't recognised. I have to build his legacy.
Yeah.
And this for me is the culmination of everything. I mean, I can't think of a better way of him affecting change in the world than through the work I do with Tommy's. So I'm enormously grateful to Tommy's for giving me that role.
You set me off again, Shima.
Sorry.
I know.
Oh.
I think Hayley and I feel very similar with this podcast. Like, this is a legacy for Luna and Bud, and to acknowledge their life and how they do exist.
It's so important. It's so important that all this grief and loss that we have suffered, and yet, you know, there is so much love for our babies.
Yeah.
And we need this love to be manifested in some kind of tangible way, because they're not here in a tangible way. It really, I mean, it, yeah, you've gone right to my core, really. Yeah, it's just, it's really amazing. And you're really creating a legacy for Altair.
And whilst you find the tissues, I'll ask the takeaways. So we do have a bit of a question we ask all of our guests. We call them the TFMR takeaways. So the question is, what advice or piece of hope would you give to women and families who are either facing a TFMR or have undergone a TFMR?
To understand, I mean, it sounds trite, but to understand that there is a way forward, and I'm not going to be patronizing and say the way forward will result definitely in a baby that you bring home. That may not happen, but the hope is there, because there will be a way through that. You will find a way to move on with your life, but that your baby will always be part of that. It maybe won't be the dominant part of your life. They will be there, and your life will grow around that grief, but you will move forward. It won't always feel as bad as it does right now.
Yeah.
Because I really remember how bad that felt.
Yeah. Thank you, Shima. It's been so wonderful having you on. And I feel like there's maybe another podcast in there for maybe a bit more exploration about your work around, you know, HIV and pregnancy and marginalized women and parents yeah. in society and that work you're doing and what you're bringing to Tommy's with that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been great having you. I really appreciate your openness and honesty as well. I wanted to remind everyone that you can subscribe to the podcast, and that's probably the best way to make sure that you get our latest episodes as they're released. And you can also follow us on our socials, which are Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Time to Talk TFMR.
Thank you, and please take gentle care of yourselves.
Thanks. Bye.